CU, the Maritime Podcast, exploring the future of shipping, one wave at a time.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are taking, well, a sledgehammer to the engine room of global commerce, the shipping industry.
It's undergoing a massive, legally mandated green overhaul, that's for sure.
Exactly. And we're diving deep into the FuelEU Maritime Regulation. This is the European Union's powerful legal tool designed not just to nudge, but to really force rapid decarbonization.
And it's a cornerstone of their whole Fit for 55 package.
It really is.
And look, this isn't just some policy paper. It's a profound market intervention. So our mission in this deep dive is to dissect the mechanics of it all.
And the mechanics of FuelEU Maritime.
Yeah, we need to understand its aggressive targets, the multi-million euro financial consequences for non-compliance, and this entirely new complex contractual framework.
The one the industry is scrambling to implement right now.
Right. The one that shifts who holds all the liability.
And the regulatory design, it sets up an immediate conflict of interest that we have to address right at the start. FuelEU places the legal responsibility for compliance and therefore the burden of any massive financial penalties on the ISM company.
Which is usually the ship manager.
Right, the ship manager. And that's the paradox, isn't it?
It is. The manager, the ISM company, carries all the legal exposure. Yet, they typically have absolutely no operational control over the ship's most critical emissions factors.
Like what fuel the ship runs on.
Or what route the charterer decides to take. The party that's liable to the government is just not the party making the critical decisions.
That structural imbalance is exactly what drove the industry to create new contract law. But before we get to the contracts, let's unpack the fundamentals. Who is actually caught in the net of FuelEU Maritime?
The scope is intentionally broad, and it's immediately applicable. The regulation applies to all vessels over 5,000 gross tonnage calling at any European port.
So it doesn't matter what flag they're flying.
Nope. Crucially, it applies regardless of the vessel's flag state, be it Panama, Liberia, or Greece. And because they chose that 5,000 GT threshold, the regulation captures something like 90% of the total CO2 emissions from the maritime sector.
Wow. And when we talk about measuring those emissions, the EU isn't allowing any shortcuts, right? It's not just about what comes out of the smokestack at sea.
Exactly. The compliance standard is based on greenhouse gas intensity. That's grams of CO2 equivalent per megajoule of energy.
Yeah.
But the critical distinction here is the use of the well-to-wake or WTW measurement.
Okay, well-to-wake.
Think of it like measuring farm-to-table emissions, but for fuel. They count all the emissions associated with that energy.
So right from the moment the fuel is extracted.
Right, through cultivation, production, transport, and finally its consumption on board the vessel. Everything.
That WTW standard, it's designed to prevent what you might call emissions laundering, right? Where you just move the pollution problem upstream to a power plant somewhere else.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
So what's the required speed of change? When does this really start to bite?
Yeah, the timeline.
It starts next year and it ramps up extremely quickly. Using the 2020 fleet average as the baseline, vessels have to show a minimum 2% reduction in GHG intensity starting in 2025.
2%, okay.
It scales gradually for the first decade, but then the curve just gets dramatically steeper. By 2040, the required reduction is 31%, and the ultimate goal is an 80% reduction by 2050.
That kind of pace? That requires fundamental technological and fuel shifts, not just, small efficiency tweaks.
Precisely.
And since ships travel all over the world, how does the EU account for voyages that only partially touch European waters?
They split the coverage. If a voyage is entirely within the EU or the European Economic Area, the EEA, then 100% of the fuels and energy used count toward compliance.
Okay, that makes sense.
But if a vessel is traveling between an EEA port and, say, a third country like Singapore or the U.S.
Then what?
Then only 50% of the fuel or energy used is included in the compliance calculation. They use that same 50% rule for voyages to or from the EU's outermost regions, too.
Got it. And beyond the fuel targets, there's also a major mandate for pollution reduction when vessels are just sitting there, right? Specifically at port.
Yes, that's another key element. And it starts in 2030. For container ships and passenger ships over 5,000 GT, they face a new obligation.
And that is?
When they're moored at the quayside, they must use onshore power supply, or OPS, or another alternative zero-emission technology.
So OPS, that means plugging the ship in, basically turning off the diesel generators.
Exactly. This phase-in starts in 2030 in ports that are designated under the Alternative Fuels Infrastructure Regulation, or AFIR.
AFIR.
Yeah, that's the regulation that handles the availability and deployment of all this new charging infrastructure. Then, by 2035, the requirement expands to all EU ports that have the capacity for OPS. It's a huge deal for cleaning up local air quality in port cities.
So we have the rules of the road. Now let's pivot to the calculus of profit and loss. This is where the EU applies enormous financial pressure to ensure compliance.
And here's where it gets really interesting, the financial consequences of non-compliance. They're no longer just bureaucratic fines. They're now massive compensation payments tied to the overall GHG deficit of a ship.
So this moves the regulation from being just a compliance challenge
to an existential financial risk.
Give us a concrete image of the penalty side. What does non-compliance look like in euros?
Okay, let's look at a common example. An older Panamax container ship running solely on traditional fossil fuels.
Okay.
In one projected scenario, that single vessel would face a total compensation payment of $1,339,000.
1.3 million euros.
And that figure combines the separate payments due under both the EU ETS, the emissions trading system, and the fuel EU maritime regulation.
Over 1 million euros for just one ship's annual emissions deficit. That's staggering.
And if you scale that up to a large fleet, think of the major charterers or owners with hundreds of ships who haven't yet transitioned.
Right.
The estimated annual compensation payments could easily reach into the hundreds of millions, possibly even billions, as the requirements tighten through the 2030s and 2040s. Yeah. That is the stick.
But the regulation also offers a huge carrot, right? Through this compliance balance, what happens if a company is ahead of the curve?
So the compliance balance measures the gap between the vessel's calculated GHG intensity and the mandatory target. If you're above the target, you have a deficit and you pay the penalty.
Simple enough.
But if you are below the target, usually by adopting low carbon fuels, you generate a compliance surplus.
And the value of that surplus, as you mentioned, is just as enormous as the penalties.
It is. Take the example of a modern container ship operating mainly in the North and Baltic seas, powered primarily by liquefied natural gas, or LNG.
Okay.
Under the current well-to-wake calculations, that vessel generates a huge compliance surplus. It translates to a projected negative annual compensation payment of $2,400,000.
Wait, a negative payment. So a 2.4 million euro advantage. Why is LNG getting such a massive benefit right now?
It's a massive incentive. And it exists because the WTW methodology currently credits LNG very highly against traditional marine gas oil. It assigns a lower upstream emission factor, which gives it a big initial advantage.
If there's a catch.
Well, it is important to note that this calculation doesn't fully account for methane slip, the release of unburned methane, a really potent greenhouse gas. That remains a major point of industry and scientific debate. But for now, from a purely financial perspective, these LNG vessels are assets.
So you have ships that are liabilities costing 1.3 million euros, and you have sister ships that are assets generating a 2.4 million euro compliance surplus. That volatility creates a market, doesn't it?
Absolutely. A market for compliance offsets.
Yep.
That's where the flexibility mechanisms come in. Companies need options to manage their balance.
What are they?
They can use banking, which is carrying a surplus forward to cover a deficit in a future year when targets are harder to meet. They can use borrowing, which is leveraging an advanced surplus from a future year to cover a current deficit.
And the big one.
And perhaps most importantly, there is pooling.
What exactly does pooling involve?
Pooling allows companies to combine the compliance balances, the surpluses, and the deficits across different ships, even if they belong to different owners and use different accredited verifiers.
So that LNG vessel with the 2.4 million surplus becomes
an extremely attractive pool partner for that fossil fuel ship carrying a 1.3 million deficit. This mechanism effectively creates an internal compliance market within the shipping sector.
Which brings us right back to the legal headache we mentioned at the start. With multi-million euro penalties in play, the ship manager, the ISM company, must be terrified of being the one legally responsible for a deficit caused by someone else's decision.
Terrified is the right word. This explosive financial risk immediately blew up the standard contractual agreements.
Which is why we have this contractual labyrinth. Specifically, the new BIMCO FuelEU Maritime Clause for Shipman 2024.
That's right. And to set the scene, BIMCO is the world's largest private shipping organization, and Shipman is the industry standard contract for ship management. They had to create this clause to address that fundamental conflict.
The conflict between financial liability and operational control.
Exactly.
So if we connect this to the bigger picture, this new clause doesn't change anything for the EU regulators, does it?
Precisely. The ISM company, the ship manager, remains the legally responsible entity toward the authorities. They are the compliance face to the government.
Okay.
But the new BIMCO clause clearly and contractually mandates that the owner is financially liable for all penalties, surcharges, and associated compliance costs. It manages the risk internally between the parties.
This means the manager's role has become heavily administrative then. What are their specific duties under this new contract?
They're essentially the data monitors and administrators. Managers are required to prepare and submit the Fuel EU monitoring plan, continuously monitor and record the vessel's actual GHG intensity.
And then do the math.
They calculate the estimated aggregated compliance balance, the cumulative surplus or deficit on a monthly or even per voyage basis. They have to keep the owner fully informed of the financial risk or reward at all times.
So the manager is logging the data and flagging the risk, but the owner holds the keys to the strategy.
Absolutely. The ultimate strategic decision-making regarding how that compliance balance is used, whether to bank it, borrow against it, or pool it, that rests exclusively with the owners.
And the owners have to tell the manager what to do.
They must provide timely instructions. If they fail to instruct the manager, or if their instruction causes a penalty, the owner bears that risk.
And to protect the manager from being stuck holding that $1.3 million bill, the BIMCO clause includes a critical security measure.
Yes. The contract requires that the owners must provide adequate security to the managers to cover their potential financial exposure to a Fuel EU penalty.
So they have to put money up front in a way.
And if the owners fail to pay required fees or penalties to the manager promptly, the managers have the right to terminate the entire management agreement immediately.
Wow.
The intent is crystal clear. The manager is an administrator, not a banker for the owner's compliance risk.
But wait, we haven't even talked about the charterers yet. They're the party who often buys the fuel and makes the route decisions that directly impact the compliance balance. Does the risk pass down to them?
It does. Through corresponding clauses that were developed for time charter parties. This is the final step in reinstating the polluter pays principle, at least contractually.
How does that work?
This clause makes the charterer financially liable for any surcharges or deficits that accrue specifically during their period of hire. The goal is to make sure the party controlling the fuel choice and the operational profile is the one who bears the financial consequences.
So if the difference between millions in profit and millions in loss rests on these complicated financial and contractual mechanisms, that entire gamble rests entirely on the quality of the data going into the system.
That is the existential question.
How can companies truly trust their numbers?
The necessity of accurate, reliable, and auditable data is paramount. The monitoring plan, which requires detailed data logging ports of call, duration, fuel consumption at sea and berth, specific emission factors, it has to be flawless.
And there are deadlines.
The annual reports must be delivered to the verifier by January 31st each year, and any inaccuracies or gaps can instantly void a surplus or trigger a penalty.
This administrative and technical burden, it seems overwhelming for a shipping company whose core business is moving containers, not regulatory accounting.
It is overwhelming. And that challenge has created a reliance on specialized technology partners like MAC System Solutions.
Okay.
They're a trusted partner in providing data-driven, web-based software and hardware specifically for ship performance and environmental regulation management. Their tools are designed to provide the verified, high-quality data you need to secure surpluses and avoid penalties.
So they cover both the physical measurement on the ship and the digital recording.
Exactly. On the physical measurement side, you need high-quality, continuous monitoring. For example, they offer specialized hardware, like the SPMNet, which is a shaft power meter, and CoreNet, a Coriolis mass flow meter.
And what do those do?
These devices ensure that fuel consumption and power output are measured with extreme accuracy, regardless of fluid properties or vessel conditions. This kind of precise data is what prevents the vulnerability of, a misreported bunker delivery note or a faulty logbook entry.
And once that impeccable data is collected on the hardware, where does it go?
It feeds into their software platforms, like SDBNet. That's a web-based platform that handles all the data logging, the high-end reporting, and the compliance calculation for all the major EU and IMO schemes.
So it's not just for FuelEU?
No, it covers FuelEU Maritime, ETS, CII, all of it. They also offer EMSNet, an electrical energy monitor that helps comply with MEPC guidelines, especially for calculating CII correction factors based on monitoring auxiliary engines or refrigerated containers, what they call reefers.
Okay, now let's detail how MAC System Solutions uses these tools to ensure clients become and stay compliant with the specific requirements of FuelEU Maritime. This is their emissions reporting FETIS service.
Right.
What does full service compliance support actually look like for a client?
It means they handle the entire complex administrative process across all the frameworks, MRV, FuelEU, ETS, SEEMP, DCS, and CII. They essentially act as the client's outsourced compliance department.
So walk us through the key steps they manage for FuelEU.
Okay, first, they manage the data management in THETIS. This is the ongoing maintenance of all relevant vessel, fleet, and annual emissions data in MSA's official THETIS portal.
So they handle the government portal directly?
Directly. Second, they're responsible for monitoring plan creation, preparing, and adjusting the complex monitoring plans required for both FuelEU and ETS compliance. Third, they handle the reporting submission. They prepare, submit, and administrate the official emission reports into THETIS on the client's behalf.
And since external auditors are involved, I imagine that coordination with the verifiers must be a major point of friction for companies.
It is. Which is why MAC includes verification and audit support. Mm-hmm. They coordinate continuously with the external verifiers and provide comprehensive support during company audits.
And what about getting the raw data from the ship?
That's the final piece. They manage the evidence gathering process, collecting and validating all the necessary documents, like bunker delivery notes, and performing critical quality assurance checks through direct communication with the crews to ensure the data is complete and accurate.
That level of service, it allows shipping companies to completely outsource the technical and regulatory administrative burden.
It does. They can focus on their core business of logistics while having total confidence that their reporting is compliant, comprehensive, and most importantly, efficient.
And in a system where efficient compliance can mean securing a multi-million euro surplus instead of paying a multi-million euro penalty, that confidence isn't just nice to have.
It's a massive competitive edge.
So let's bring all this back to the listener. What does this all mean at the end of the day?
Well, the shipping industry is navigating unprecedented waters. They have to simultaneously meet the EU's strict and accelerating decarbonization targets while managing these tectonic shifts in financial and contractual liability dictated by the new BIMC clauses.
So success demands two things.
Two things. An operational transition to low-carbon fuels and administrative excellence in data collection and reporting. You can't have one without the other.
Given the immediate multi-million euro financial incentives we've talked about, clearly shown by those LNG examples, the difference between a massive loss and a massive competitive advantage. The question is no longer if shipping companies will transition to low carbon fuels.
No, the market has already decided that.
The real question is how fast they will adopt the necessary robust data management systems and contractual frameworks to streamline compliance, avoid those catastrophic deficits, and successfully capitalize on the potential nine-figure compliance surpluses.
That race for data accuracy and clean fuel isn't just starting. It is the dominant factor in maritime finance today.
This podcast is supported by MaxSystemSolutions.com, your service partner for digital efficiency, regulatory compliance, and sustainable performance in commercial shipping and maritime transport. For more information, please visit our website and see you in the next episode.